Welcome back to Books with Bert. I'm Bert Folsom, author of the book FDR Goes to War, with my co-author Anita Folsom. Did you know that under communist governments, an average of one person was killed every 31 seconds during the 100 years of the 20th century? That story is largely untold in U.S. history textbooks and is the subject of today's podcast entitled Russia, Communism, and Textbook Bias. But before we get into today's episode, I want to remind you that if you like my podcasts and you want to learn more about the wonderful and forgotten stories in American history, don't forget to rate and review my podcast on Spotify, iTunes, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to share with your family and friends, too. Today's podcast is on Russia and communism. Communism is a form of government developed by Karl Marx. The goal of communism was to spread the wealth and create equality of condition. But in practice, communist countries have always been ruthless dictatorships. A communist revolution first came to Russia in 1917, and Russia's first two leaders, Vladimir Lenin and Joseph Stalin, concentrated power, controlled the military, and ruled Russia by terror. 3 years after the Russian Revolution in 1920, industrial output in Russia was about 10% of the levels before communism under the Tsarist regime in Russia. H.G. Wells, the British socialist, thought that Russia might be the vision of a new future. He came there and was appalled. And he said this, quote, "Russia in 1920 presented an unparalleled example of civilization in a state of complete collapse. The railway tracks were rusting. The cities were falling into ruin." We know that from 1917 to 1921, about 5 million Russians had starved to death. And there would have been more, except that the United States, after World War I, gave 700 tons of food to Russia, also gave food to other European countries. The generosity of the United States saved Russia from even more deaths. Comrade Lenin, the head of Russia, said, quote, "Our program was right in theory, but impractical. Marx himself never considered this problem of creating a communist state." How could Lenin, and later Stalin, maintain their power when their country was in shambles? With government control, no one in Russia had any incentive to produce much of anything. Werner Keller wrote a marvelous book called East Minus West Equals Zero. And in that book, he helps explain Stalin's strategy, Lenin's too. They believed that through a new economic plan, a five-year plan, various types of plans, that they could buy equipment, buy, borrow, or perhaps steal equipment from the Western nations and then have the Russians build on that equipment and become a leading nation. Lenin called this strategy industrial cohabitation with the capitalists. He then said, "As soon as we are strong enough to overthrow capitalism, we shall seize it by the throat." He said if his policy was successful, that is, of borrowing and stealing and buying from Western nations, quote, "Thanks to it, we will be able to create new model industrial enterprises comparable with those of the most modern capitalist states." Therefore, Russia began buying from Germany such things as steel plants. Krupp Steel in Germany built steel plants to help Russia mechanize their agriculture. Another German company, Link Hoffman Works, built rails and also sold trains to Russia. Hugo Junkers built aircraft. And so from Germany, Russia got quite a bit of industrial equipment. Denmark built the Trans-Siberian Cable. Sweden contributed locomotives. The country of England built gold mining and copper mining equipment and also sold textile equipment to Russia. The United States was involved as well, selling and loaning equipment to Russia. Henry Ford trained Russian engineers and built 140,000 cars in Russia. The Russian engineers then took over and kicked out Henry Ford. Arthur McKee built the steel town of Magnitogorsk, and it became a steel town in Russia. Engineer Elwood Rising helped build a tractor factory. Another American, Hugh Cooper, who worked for the Tennessee Valley Authority in the United States, built Dnipestroy, the largest hydroelectric plant in the world. The question here is, how does Russia pay for all this economic development that it is importing from the West? As the title of Werner Keller's book indicates, East minus West equals zero. In other words, the Russians can't produce anything by themselves. They don't have the incentives and the freedom. They have to borrow from the Western nations who do have freedom. How does Russia pay for all this? Russia was very secretive, but the way they ended up paying for this was through food and the food exports to Europe and other areas of the world. The food was supplied by Ukrainian farmers and other farmers in Russia who had their food confiscated by the Russian government and then sold to the West to provide this equipment and industrial enterprise for Russia. The peasants from whom this grain was stolen ended up dying by hundreds of thousands, and as we later learned, by the millions. Because Western nations did not quite understand how Russia was becoming an industrial power, we did not know the deaths that were being caused by it. Franklin Roosevelt, president of the United States during the 1930s, simply did not believe the negative rumors about Stalin. He thought Stalin was an honest person. He trusted Stalin, and he was anxious to work with Stalin in World War II to defeat Hitler. Hitler was seen by Roosevelt, and in fairness, by many others, as being the prime enemy. Hitler and fascism being more of an enemy than Stalin and communism. Russia and the United States were major allies in World War II, and Russia was propped up by Roosevelt and American contributions of food, weapons, and other industrial material. And these resources Stalin used to help build Russia, as well as used to defeat Hitler. Now, before the end of World War II, Roosevelt died and Harry Truman became president. Truman was much more suspicious of Stalin. And when he saw that Stalin was controlling Bulgaria, Yugoslavia, Romania, in a very heavy-handed manner, that Eastern European countries were falling under the dominion of communism, and that Stalin was trying to infiltrate Italy, France, and other nations of Europe as well, Truman became suspicious and thought Stalin is no longer to be trusted. We ended up breaking ties with Russia in 1946, and some historians call this the beginning of the Cold War, a war that doesn't involve pitched battles, but espionage, and the Russians trying to steal and borrow from the United States to secure its military position in the world. How does the textbook treat the rise of the Cold War and the relationship between Russia and the United States? I want to go back to the leading American history textbook written by David Kennedy and Elizabeth Cohen, entitled The American Pageant. It has sold millions of copies. It is, we believe, the most widely used textbook in the United States, used heavily in high school classes, also in college classes. How does this textbook, The American Pageant, deal with this Soviet-American split? Here's what the textbook says, quote, it's talking here about the Cold War in 1946, the break between Russia and the United States. Quote, the Washington government rubbed salt in Soviet wounds when it abruptly terminated vital lend-lease aid to a battered Russia in 1945 and spurned Moscow's plea for a $6 billion reconstruction loan, while approving a similar loan of $3.75 billion to Britain in 1946. Different visions of the post-war world also separated the two superpowers. End quote. Well, the textbook is outrageous in this analysis. Stalin and Hitler formed an alliance in 1939 and mutually invaded Poland to carve it up between them. Later, when Hitler double-crossed Stalin and invaded Russia, Stalin begged for U.S. aid. Roosevelt, who called Stalin Uncle Joe, concluded that, quote, something entered into Stalin's nature of the way in which a Christian gentleman should behave, end quote. Roosevelt, therefore, eagerly sent food and supplies, costing billions of dollars to support Stalin. Stalin, meanwhile, took the American goods, killed a million of his own people, did help to defeat Hitler, and also honeycombed the U.S. government with American communist spies, eager to report U.S. plans to the Soviets. Yet the textbook says, quote, the Washington government rubbed salt in Soviet wounds when it abruptly terminated vital lend-lease aid to a battered Russia in 1945. We would not give them any more free goodies. And the textbook has a, quote, shame on the United States attitude. In fact, the text has a notion that the United States and Russia were merely two rivals. The textbook uses the term different visions to describe the difference between the United States and Russia. But what the textbook does not say is that the U.S. vision was to aid and promote free societies in the world, and the Soviet vision was to infiltrate other nations and conquer them and enslave their people when possible. 5 pages later, the textbook talks about the Marshall Plan, which is the United States' effort to help Western Europe with free aid to rebuild the countries of Western Europe after the war. We also did this with Japan. The textbook says this, quote, the Marshall Plan called for spending $12.5 billion over 4 years in 16 cooperating countries. Congress at first balked at this mammoth sum. It looked even more huge when added to the nearly $2 billion the United States had already contributed to European relief. And that's true because the United States after the war had already sent food and supplies over to Western Europe and even some of the Eastern European countries to keep them from starving after World War II. 2 points need to be made here. First, the United States, unlike all other victorious nations in world history, funded the rebuilding of other countries, even some not so friendly to the United States, after World War II. Usually the winners ransack the losers and demand reparations. Russia, in fact, did exactly this in Germany after World War II. Russia demanded reparations from Germany in the form of industrial equipment after World War II. My second point here is the textbook implies that the United States aid was a dominant force in the recovery of Europe. However, aid alone could not produce a prosperous Europe. Adopting free markets was crucial, as the, quote, economic miracle, end quote, in West Germany showed the world. Germany, which had been absolutely devastated by World War II, had a dramatic recovery in the late 1940s and early 1950s under Ludwig Erhard, who adopted free markets, low taxes, and had much economic growth. What about this issue of the Soviet spies? They were important to Russia because the Soviet spies, and there were dozens of them, in the United States were transferring information about United States political policy, military policy, and economic policy to Stalin and the Russians. Therefore, the United States was being undermined within our own country by spies who were working for the communist government in Russia. The textbook looks into the group that was formed in Congress to investigate infiltration of the United States. It was the House Un-American Activities Committee, which was formed in 1938. Now, here's what the textbook says, quote, the House of Representatives in 1938 had established the Committee on Un-American Activities, popularly known as HUAC, HUAC, to investigate subversion. In 1948, committee member Richard M. Nixon, an ambitious red catcher, led the chase after Alger Hiss, a prominent ex-New Dealer and a distinguished member of the Eastern establishment. Accused of being a communist agent in the 1930s, Hiss demanded the right to defend himself. He dramatically met his chief accuser before the Un-American Activities Committee in August of 1948. Hiss, under oath, denied everything, but was caught in embarrassing falsehoods. He was convicted of perjury in 1950 and sentenced to 5 years in prison, end quote. The textbook here is so anxious to poo-poo the House Un-American Activities Committee and Richard Nixon, quote, an ambitious red catcher, that the student never learns that Alger Hiss was guilty as charged of lying under oath about his Communist Party membership, his espionage work for the Soviets, and his key role as a spokesman in the State Department for the United States in negotiations with Stalin at the Yalta Conference after World War II. This conference ultimately granted hegemony to Russia in much of Eastern Europe, and Alger Hiss was moving the United States to approve of the Russian domination. The recent opening of Soviet archives confirms Hiss's guilt and the accuracy of his accuser, a man named Whitaker Chambers, whom the textbook chooses not to mention. Chambers' remarkable book entitled Witness is a riveting account of the efforts of Hiss and other communists in the United States to undermine the United States and smuggle important documents to Russia. Richard Nixon, who was not a good president in the 1970s, was a hero in the 1940s for his role in convicting Hiss and liberating many American agencies from communist infiltration. The House Un-American Activities Committee, their historic investigation of communist influences in the American government in 1948, identified Hiss and many others who had been smuggling documents to Russia. More than that, the accurate testimony of Whitaker Chambers and Elizabeth Bentley in the HUAC hearings pinpointed Soviet agents in sensitive positions in many important government agencies, including the White House, the State Department, the military, the Treasury, and the Office of Strategic Services, which was the future CIA. In other words, the textbook thinks very little of the Russian spying and transferring of documents to Russia. What about this whole business of Russia getting the atomic bomb? Remember, Russia is not creative. Werner Keller's book is entitled East minus West equals Zero. So how does Russia get an atomic bomb? Obviously, they can't buy one from the United States. Therefore, the effort was to use the spies within the United States working for Russia to transfer this information. Two of the spies were Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. The question here is, what does the textbook say about the trial and conviction of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg for transferring secrets to Russia to help Russia build the atomic bomb? Here's what the textbook says, quote, "The stunning success of Soviet scientists in developing an atomic bomb was attributed by many to the cleverness of communist spies in stealing American secrets. Notorious among those who had allegedly leaked atomic data to Moscow were two American citizens, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. They were convicted in 1951 of espionage, and after prolonged appeals, went to the electric chair in 1953, the only people in American history ever executed in peacetime for espionage. Their sensational trial and electrocution, combined with the sympathy for their two orphan children, began to sour some sober citizens on the excesses of the Red Hunters." In other words, the textbook is sympathetic with the Rosenbergs. The first sentence has some truth in it. That is, the Soviet espionage agents, led by the Rosenbergs, were clever in stealing American secrets. But the rest of this textbook statement is nonsense. Both Julius and Ethel Rosenberg willfully, not allegedly as the textbook says, willfully leaked atomic data to Moscow. They also passed along information to the Soviets on American rockets, airplanes, and radar. The textbook wants students to focus their attention on the two orphaned children rather than on the secrets that were given to the Russians by the Rosenbergs. When the Rosenbergs were accurately convicted for their smuggling to Russia of notes and a sketch of the lens device on the Nagasaki atomic bomb, Judge Irving Kaufman sentenced them to execution, and he explained his sentence this way, quote, "I consider your crime worse than murder. And by putting into the hands of the Russians the atomic bomb, years before our best scientists predicted Russia would perfect the bomb, has already caused, in my opinion, the communist aggression in Korea with the resultant casualties to the United States exceeding 50,000. Some defenders of the Rosenbergs say the information they stole was not that valuable. But Soviet spy Anatoly Yatskov conceded in 1995 that the stolen material was, quote, of huge invaluable significance, end quote, for the Soviets. An excellent book on this subject is entitled The Rosenberg File by Ronald Radish and Joyce Milton, written in 1983. That book was readily available to David Kennedy and Elizabeth Cohen, the authors of the book, The American Pageant, but they chose not to use the material in that book. Instead, they chose to portray the Rosenbergs as being people who were persecuted by the United States government. The textbook, The American Pageant, is bad, but a worse argument on the Rosenbergs is presented in Howard Zinn's book, A People's History of the United States. Zinn was actually a member of the Communist Party, and his textbook, which has sold more than 1 million copies, it's really close to 2 million copies at this point, that textbook has been used by hundreds of thousands of students in universities and high schools all over the United States. Zinn constantly defends the Russians and is critical of the United States. Zinn, in defending the Rosenbergs, says they were framed by the U.S. government, that it was bias, that the U.S. government willfully framed the Rosenbergs. For Zinn, the execution of the Rosenbergs was, quote, a demonstration to the people of the country of what lay at the end of the line for those the government decided were traitors, end quote. In other words, the Rosenbergs were persecuted by the United States government. They were set up in that trial. They were murdered by the U.S. government when they were executed. The truth is not only presented by Ronald Radish in his book, The Rosenberg File, but other truth has come to light later. In 2008, the Rosenberg co-defendant, a man named Morton Sobel, who had spent 19 years in Alcatraz and other prisons, and at that point was 91 years old, admitted that he and Julius Rosenberg had indeed been spies. Zinn mentions Sobel on page 434 of his book, claiming that the case against him was so weak that Sobel's attorney had decided there was no need to present a defense. Sobel's admission led the Rosenbergs' two sons to acknowledge for the first time that their father had been a spy. In other words, the Rosenberg children admitted their father was a spy. Martin Sobel admits he's a spy. And then Ronald Radish, who wrote that book, The Rosenberg File, says that he was unhappy that college textbooks still presented the innocent Rosenberg, so-called innocent, as being deprived of a fair trial or guilty of passing inconsequential information. An excellent book in talking about Zinn and exposing Zinn's lack of truth is by Mary Graybar. Her book is entitled Debunking Howard Zinn. She says, in truth, the Rosenbergs not only tried their best to give the Soviets top atomic secrets from the Manhattan Project, they succeeded in handing over top military data on sonar and radar that was used by the Russians to shoot down American planes in the Korean and Vietnam Wars. Graber goes on to say this, When Howard Zinn was contacted by the New York Times in 2008, after the revelations that the Rosenbergs were indeed guilty by admission of their two children and by Martin Sobel, Zinn said, "I never was going along saying I know that they are innocent, and I'm not shocked by the fact that they turned out to be spies. But to me, it doesn't matter whether they were guilty or not." The point of Zinn's book is to try to make an argument to promote communism, not to arrive at any sort of truth. When he can embarrass the United States, he does so, and his book has been reissued with his negative statements about the United States government setting up the Rosenbergs. In fact, the Rosenbergs were guilty and represent espionage of secrets that went to the Russians and kept the Russians and their despotic regime dominating much of the world for another generation. What conclusions can we make about Russia, communism, and textbook bias? The major point here is that textbooks avoid serious criticism of Russia in particular and communism in general. Therefore, students do not know about the mass murders and the enslavement of people ruled by communist governments. Howard Zinn, who is a communist himself, consistently attacked the United States. His textbook consistently supports those who want to undermine the United States government. These distortions, Zinn's book, after all, is written in the 1980s. The textbook written by Kennedy and Cohen has been active and selling very well during the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. These distortions have helped to lead a generation of millennials to be misinformed about communism and Russia. Surveys show that about one-third, maybe even one-half of millennials sympathize with socialism and sometimes even communism. These millennials have been so poorly taught about the United States and Russia by mainstream textbooks and by Howard Zinn's book that they are unwilling to defend the United States. They do not believe that the United States government has value greater than socialist or communist governments in the world. This is an important subject, communism, Russia, and textbook bias. I have a couple additional books I want to recommend. Robert Conquest's book, Harvest of Sorrow, on the killings under Russia in the 1920s, 30s, and even later. Also, I'd like to recommend David Satter's book, The Decline and Fall of the Soviet Union. And that concludes today's episode of Books with Bert. Thank you all for listening. Be sure to subscribe and rate my podcast on Spotify, iTunes, Apple, or any other place where you can get podcasts. I don't want you to miss future episodes. If you like today's episode, if you want to find more content to fill your heart with love for America and for conservative ideas, be sure to check out YAF.org. The conservative movement starts here. Until next time, keep reading.